There we go. But I want to start by asking you, if you could have one thing that you think could make your life easier tomorrow, what would that one thing be? Would it be more money? Would it be more time? Would it be more strength? Would it be more opportunities? Would it be more a different position at work? Maybe it would just be a better ability to control the things going on in your life. And while all those things may sound different, and we all probably have different things that we would point to say that that would make my life easier, I think they all have one thing in common. Ask yourself why we want those things. What is the why behind wanting more money? Well, it's because if we have more money, we can buy more things that we don't have. We can afford ourselves more things. If we have more control, we have the ability to make decisions over our lives that might not be up to us to make. All of those things give us the ability to do something. And so really, I think the core to every single one of those things is the idea of power. It's power. Because at it, the most core, simple level, power just allows us to do something. It gives us the ability to do something. It gives us the ability to change or accomplish or overcome or control things. And if we're honest about our own lives, I think it's tempting to want to live in a way that puts power at the forefront of our minds. To live in a way that says, I just need more. I need more. I'm missing this. I don't have enough of it. To live in a way that says, if I had more power, I would be able to change my circumstances. I would not have to worry about this or that. If I had enough power, I could protect the people I want. I could guarantee my future. I could overcome everything standing in my way. If I just had a little bit more money, a little bit more influence, if I just had enough control, then my life would finally be right where I want it to be. But what I want to explore tonight through the book of Judges is the idea that maybe power isn't the biggest problem we have, or the lack of power. Perhaps our biggest problem is that we've forgotten the true source of power. And so go ahead and open up your Bibles to Judges chapter 3. That's where we'll be looking tonight, specifically between verses 12 to 30. Judges chapter 3, 12 to 30. And it's going to explore this idea of power through a very interesting story. But as we talk about this, I want you to note just one question. Keep one question in the back of your mind. I want you to be asking yourself, where does true power come from? Now, as I said, as we noted a couple weeks ago, when we first introduced the idea of judges, we noted that Israel was falling into the cycle of sin. They would be doing the right thing, coming off of Joshua as their leader, and then they would turn and start doing what was right in their own eyes. And so God would send a judge. He would take them away from who would save them from a nation that came in and conquered them because of their sins. And then after a little bit of time of peace, they would then sin again. And that's exactly what we note in verse 12 here. But before we start looking at our judge, we need to see how the author here describes the conflict, which is Moab. And so just look at verses 12 through 14 with me. Judges 3, 12 through 14. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He gathered to himself the Ammonites and the Amalekites and went and defeated Israel, and they took possession of the city of palms. And the people of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. All right, we'll stop there for a moment. See, everything that we read about Moab in this section here proclaims one thing. They're powerful. They have all the power. Look at everything we just learned about them right here. We're told that they're strong and they're dominant. They are so powerful, they're able to bring in these other nations to help conquer Israel. They conquered Israel, for example, to show their power. They have possession over the land. They have ruled over God's people. Now it says 18 years. They are the powerful nation of Moab. And then at the center of this very powerful nation is a king named Eglon. And I'll say this right out the bat. Our villain and our hero of the story, Eglon and Ehud. Eglon's the bad guy. Ehud's the good guy. I'm sorry if I mistake him. It might happen. But back to the story. Back to Eglon. we'll see that he kind of becomes the physical embodiment of power himself. We get a description of him in verse 17, if you just skim down there, where we're told that he is a very large man. He's this very large man. And while it'd be easy to stop and laugh about the comedy of how the author chooses to write this story, I think it's written in a very specific purpose to tell us he's the embodiment of wealth, of luxury, of abundance. He's basically everything about him is saying, I have, right? I have all these things. I've got the wealth. With Moab, he's saying, I have the armies, I have the strength, as He-Man would say, I have the power, right? He's everything, I have control. 18 years now, by the way, 18 years where Eglon has ruled over Israel with Moab. And I think in this, Moab kind of represents how the world typically understands power. It's the idea that power is something that we can possess, that we can hold on to that. But even more so, they take this idea of power and go further with it. They say that power, in its purest form, is meant to be loud. It's meant to be seen. You're meant to show off how powerful you are. Power must be seen. It builds monuments. It gathers armies. It displays its wealth. So it's so clear that it's embodied by this fat, large king on a throne. That's what power looks like in Moab's eyes. And I think that's typically how the world likes to see it. Power says, look at us. Look at what we have. Look at what we are able to do. We do the same thing with money, with influence, with success, with all those things we talked about at the start of today. We look at those things and we say, that's power. The ability to have all the money, to have control over people. That's what power looks like to the world. It's something you can acquire and display, something you can possess. But there's something very interesting in this grand picture of power that we see through Eglon and Moab. Look at verse 12 again, because we get it's almost humorous what we're told about Eglon's power here. Verse 12 says that all of this great power that we've talked about Eglon and Moab having, the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab. So where did this power come from? Where did he get all of this great, mighty power? Well, before we even see him, before we read verse 17, which gives us this description, we're let in on a little secret about his power. It's not his at all. It's given to him by God. All of this power that we see him wielding, it's all borrowed by God. It's gifted to him by God. There's something very interesting in that. The only true power he had was just lended to him. Meaning Eglon could gather all the armies he wanted. He could display his wealth as much as he wanted. He could rule over Israel as if everything belonged to him. But it would never change the fact that his power wasn't his own. It was only God's. And the reason I bring this up is because it makes this next thing that happens very interesting. There is a heavy contrast in how this next character is introduced. And so let's look at the text and see how God responds to Eglon's and Moab's supposed show of power. Look at verse 15 with me, and we'll read to the end of this story here. Verse 15. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and the Lord raised up for them a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. The people of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab, and Ehud made for himself a sword with two edges, a cubit in length, and bound it on his right thigh under his clothes. And he presented the tribute to Eglon, the king of Moab. Now Eglon was a very fat man, and when Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who carried the tribute. But he himself turned back on the idols near Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And he commanded silence, and all his attendants went out from his presence. And Ehud came to him as he was sitting alone in the cool roof chamber. And Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And he arose from his seat. And Ehud reached with his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. And the hilt also went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not pull the sword out of his belly, and the dung came out. Then Ehud went out into the porch and closed the doors of the roof chamber behind him and locked them. All right. We'll stop there. We'll pause for a moment. Obviously, there's some interesting things in there that could be funny to laugh at for a little bit. But notice just the depiction of Ehud. Just this picture of Ehud. He's not very impressive. This seems a little strange, right? After this depiction of 18 years, the powerful Moab ruling over Israel, their powerful king, this great nation, who does God raise up to defeat them, to bring his people back? Ehud. Just one guy. Really? One man? This not very special man either. We're not told much about him. We're not told that he has a great army behind him. We're not told that he has a bunch of status or great strength. We aren't given some impressive resume where he's defeated all these many nations in his past. So clearly he's a professional. Right? There's nothing that gives us confidence that where it says, oh, of course, this guy is going to defeat Moab, this powerful nation. This one man can definitely take out all these people and keep the people of Israel, protect them. And actually, it's kind of interesting. The only depiction of Ehud that we get, the only description of him is that he's left-handed. And while some people theorize that the idea there is that his right hand was probably disabled in some way, so he wasn't able to use his right hand. And so that would probably add to this idea that he's not very impressive. He's not your typical picture of a very mighty, strong soldier. But even if we don't say that, even if that's not true, I would just put before you, how do you like your mighty soldiers and champions described? Is it, I like the Ehud, the 10-foot giant with a massive spear and a big, strong muscles. Not the, oh, this is Ehud, the guy from Benjamin who's left-handed. That's not very impressive. There's nothing very impressive in this title. I want Ehud the Great, the Mighty. No, it's just Ehud, the left-handed guy from Benjamin. While everything about Moab was about how strong they are, about how mighty they are, about how impressive they were, God just says, look, here's Ehud. But notice what the scriptures emphasize. Notice what it says in verse 15. It simply says, the Lord raised up for them a deliverer. That's it. And that right there is the key to this whole story. That's where the victory begins. It'd be tempting to read the rest of the story and say, well, Ehud won when he cleverly made his sword that was able to sneak his way into the Eglon's chambers, right? Or Ehud won when he hit it on his right side and hit it from the guards. That's when he won. Or maybe he won when he actually put the sword in Eglon's belly and when Eglon fell and died. That's when Ehud won. That's not when Ehud won. He won in verse 15 when it says, and the Lord raised up for them a deliverer. He won because the Lord was with him. And I think the whole point of this is the very fact that Ehud was never going to be powerful enough. He was never going to be strong enough, but he didn't have to be because God is. God was powerful enough. He was the one that was going to win the whole time. And that's what makes what happens next in the story so ironic in a way. Ehud makes himself a short, double-edged sword and hides it on his right thigh. He carries Israel's tribute into the presence of this massive, large king. He delivers it, leaves, turns around, and then tells Eglon, oh, I have a secret message for you, O king. Eglon, maybe doubting that this man's ability to do any harm to him, sends his guards away, says, all right. Ehud tells him, I have a message from you. And verse 21 through 22 says, and Ehud reached with his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. You see that reversal there that's going on here? Everything that looked powerful about Eglon could not save him. Where were his guards when the sword was going into him? Where was his wealth and his might? What did his many soldiers, what did his wealth, his power do for him as he was lying on the floor? What did any of it do for him when he faced a champion of God? So again, I think this idea is that God's power is pitted against what the world sees as powerful. God's power is going to look different from how the world pictures power. It's not going to look loud like Moab's power. God's power instead is quiet. When Moab gathered armies, God just raised one man. Where Moab displayed its strength, well, we see Ehud hiding his sword, sneaking in. Eglon looked like he possessed everything, and Ehud simply used what God had given him. And yet the truth is, which one was actually powerful? In the end, which one actually held all power? It was the one that had God by his side. And I think that's the whole point of the story. Ehud didn't need to be enough because God was enough. And this has very important implications for us today. I think we can have a tendency to measure significance by size. We can think that influence needs a power, that leadership needs a title, that usefulness means doing something that everybody else notices, that everybody else can see. That if God was really going to use me, surely He would give me something bigger, something more important to my eyes, something more impressive, something that feels more important. But Ehud's entire story only worked precisely because he went unnoticed. If the guards had seen his sword, what good would it have been? If they had seen him as a big physical threat, what good would he have been? But in the end, he was actually more powerful than they could have possibly imagined. Ehud had a sword in the unexpected hand. He was all alone in enemy territory. He was surrounded by guards. What could one man possibly do on his own? But the truth is, God has never needed enough from us because He is always enough. And this means that some of the most powerful things we'll ever be able to do might be the things that nobody notices at all. They might be just teaching your child the truth. It might be just refusing a temptation that nobody else knows. It might be just teaching a single person about Christ because that can change their life forever. Just one person. And when I say that, it's teaching one person, not saying, look at all the people I'm teaching. I'm just sharing the Word of God, simply showing up, serving in an unnoticed capacity. That's what power looks like when we have God with us. And the world may call those things small. They may call us weak for not seeking attention, for not seeking appreciation. But the truth is, there is no assignment too small when it comes from God. Because the power of an assignment isn't determined by the size of what God places in our hands. It's powerful because God put it there. That's the truth. Ehud didn't need Eglon's wealth. He didn't need Moab's army. He didn't need their status. He didn't need their apparent strength. He simply needed God. He needed to be faithful with what God had done for him. And so maybe the question for us isn't how much power has God given me? What has He put in my hands? It's simply, have I been faithful with what God has given me? And if I'm waiting for God to give me more of this, to do this in my life, and then I'll start to be faithful, and then I'll start to serve in the way that I know He wants me to serve, well, then I've completely misviewed what God has planned for my life. If I don't think God's given me enough, I've completely misunderstood what God is doing with my life. See, Ehud's response is essentially, because God gave me His word, because I was called by God, that is enough for me. Are we asking ourselves, is that enough for us? We have been called. Is that enough for us, or are we waiting for this or that? And I think this is where the story starts to become uncomfortable. Because if what God has given me is enough to accomplish what God has asked of me, well, then what does it say when I say it's not enough? What does that say about my attitude, about how I look at the world when I say, God, You haven't given me enough. I don't have enough to do what You've asked me to do. What does it say when I believe that I need more control, I need more security, I need more knowledge, more influence, more certainty in my life? See, the truth is, at some point, the question stops being whether I have enough. The question simply becomes whether I trust the God who gave it. Do I trust God or not? And that's where the temptation of power actually starts to creep in. See, when I decide that God hasn't given me enough, and that's what I'm saying, when I'm grabbing for all these other things, it's God hasn't provided for me enough. When I make that declaration, I start trying to supply what I think He's left out. I make plans for what I cannot know. I grab for things that He has not given me, and hold on to that one because we'll come back to that idea in a second. But we start trying to build walls around things that I cannot protect. We start trying to make certainty, or we have not been promised certainty. And in all of this, there is a great irony. See, Judges has shown us two completely different relationships with the idea of power. Eglon lived as though power was something he possessed. Ehud lived as though power was something God provided. And as I said, I want to talk about this idea of grabbing power that He has not given us. Because in this idea of power, we get a very moving demonstration in Genesis, actually. In Genesis, we get this very idea laid out for us by a man grabbing for something that was not given to him. And so notice how Genesis talks about this in Genesis chapter 3. Now, last time we were in Judges, we actually looked at the same story, but we looked at it through the lens of Eve. This time I want to specifically look at it through Adam's lens, though. See how he viewed the temptation. In Genesis 3:1, the serpent comes into the story. And verses 4 and 5 is where we're going to start. Verses 4 and 5, because I want you to see that the temptation is not simply about a fruit. He doesn't just say, come eat this fruit. Instead, notice the words that he says in verses 4 and 5. Genesis chapter 3. But the serpent said to woman, you will not surely die, for God knows that you will eat, when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. We'll stop there. The serpent here says, you will be like God. That's his temptation. That's ultimately his temptation. You can have what God has not given you. He's promising Adam more than what God had given him. God told him, don't eat of the fruit. You don't need that. Satan comes in, tempts him, says, you need more. You haven't been given enough. And then notice what this leads to in verse 6, when Adam eventually does grab the fruit. He says, I do want that. He reaches out. He takes possession of what God had told him, you do not need, believing that his life would be better if he just had this one thing. But the result, as we all know, is the exact opposite of that. It leads to death. It leads to exile. So in the pursuit of more, it led to him losing what he already had. And so this is why I bring this story up, though. When Adam tried to grab the fruit, he was trying to grab more power, to grab what he believed he didn't have. But notice, go back to chapter 1 and verse 26 to 28. You see, Adam was grasping for power when God had already given him power. Genesis 1, 28 says, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. In Genesis chapter 3, Adam reached for more power, for a higher standing, to become like God. But in Genesis 1:28, God had already given him dominion. He had given him authority. He had given him purpose and a mission. Adam had already received power from God. But he wanted power apart from God. I think that's the real key to this. It's he wanted power separate from God for himself. And so in grasping for what he did not have, he lost what he already had. He lost his dominion. He was kicked out of the garden, kicked out of the presence of God. Adam reached because he believed God has not given me all that I should have. And that is a very tempting thought, a very dangerous thought. And today, every temptation, I think, echoes the same premise. It's the draw towards worldly power. It's the same cry from the serpent. It's if you only had more, if you only had this, you could have more money, more influence, more success, more control, more recognition. But underneath all of it is the same accusation that Adam did when he grabbed the fruit. It's God, you have not given me enough. God, I need more. You've not provided what I need. And while we may never say that to God, I think our actions speak a whole lot louder than words. And so allow me to ask, how do we live when we don't know what's going to happen? I think that's the key to all of this. When we are forced to trust in God, do we reach for self-power or do we rely on God? How do we respond when we don't have enough money, when we don't have enough control over a decision that might affect us? What happens when our obedience might cost us something that we aren't guaranteed to have back? What happens when God has given us an assignment that we don't feel equipped for? The truth is, our grasping for power says, if I become powerful enough, well, I won't need God. I won't need to depend on anyone, because the true source of power, the reason it's tempting, is because it promises independence. It promises the ability to not need to rely on anybody, to not need to trust anyone, to not need to have someone else providing for my needs. If I can become strong enough, wealthy enough, knowledgeable enough, influential enough, prepared enough, then I won't have to depend on anyone else. And God is at the forefront of that. Power promises that eventually I can become enough for myself. And that is why the pursuit of power becomes so dangerous. It isn't simply about wanting more money or more influence or more control. It's the pursuit of self-reliance. Because underneath all of our grasping for control is a confession that we would probably never make with our own mouths. I don't want to need you, God. That's what we're telling him, and we're trying to grab things, telling him, I can provide for myself. I know what's best for me. I know what you've left out of my life that I need. I know better for myself, and I don't want to have to wait for you to give it. I don't want to have to wait for you to give me the ability. I don't want to need you. When we believe that God hasn't given it us, we start to try to acquire more, just like Adam. We grab hold of more, build our power, become self-reliant, all so that we can cut God out of our needs. But one of the greatest ironies in all of this is found when Adam reached for more power. Because instead of making humanity powerful, his grasp revealed just how powerless we truly are. And so I want you to notice this beautiful connection real quick. See, just like Ehud and Judges, humanity's greatest problem was never that we lacked earthly problems. Ehud's lack of power was not the problem he faced. The problem that we face today is that we're powerless over the thing we probably fear most. Death. Nobody has power over death. No man has power over death. Adam believed that God had not given him all that he should have. But when humanity was truly powerless, the truth is God gave us what we could never provide for ourselves. He gave us his son. He gave us salvation. We chased power because we want control over life. But death was something we could never defeat, and so he gave us Christ. And I want you to see how Hebrews 2:14-15 says this, because it is a beautiful reversal. Hebrews 2:14-15 says, "Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself, Christ, likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has power over death," that is the devil, "and deliver all those through fear of death, who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery." If power is all about wanting more, what more could God give us than that? What more could we possibly have than Christ, who gives us power over the one thing we could never have power over? Christ destroyed the one who had power over death. He freed those who lived in slavery because of their fear. This reversal is incredible. Adam reached for power and found death. Christ entered death and broke its power over us. Christ took on death and brought life. Adam tried to seize what belonged to God, where Christ submitted his entire life to God's will to give us life. And now, because of Jesus' sacrifice, Christians receive what Adam tried to obtain. Not the power to become God, but the power to live our lives for God. And so notice how Paul writes this in Ephesians 6:10. Because Christian strength begins by trusting in this very fact. Ephesians 6:10 simply says, "Be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might." Notice here where Paul locates the source of our strength. It's not in ourself. It's not in what we can acquire. It's not in how much we can gain. It's not in "be strong in me and in the strength of my might." He says, "Be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might." The Lord is the source. The world likes to say power is the ability to control life, but the gospel tells us the exact opposite. True power comes when we submit our lives to God, when we give over control of our lives. We hand it all over to the one who has power. Meaning life is not about building myself up. It's about handing myself over. And once we do that, God gives us the power to resist sin, to fight temptation, to stand up against the devil, to endure suffering, to love sacrificially, to forgive, to remain faithful, to conquer death. But true strength begins when we surrender our pursuit of control. And so to the end tonight, I want us to go back to Judges just one more time to see how it paints the perfect picture of worldly power. Judges 3. After everything that we saw Moab and Eglon possess, look at verse 25. Verse 25. And they waited there till they were embarrassed. But when he still did not open the doors of the roof chamber, they took the key and opened them. And there lay their Lord, dead on the floor. The mighty king, the wealthy king, the king of abundance, the king of all earthly power, this fear king, the ruler everyone depended on, dead on the floor. The nation that fled to Israel, where were they? They could not protect their king. The king who ruled over others, well, he could not save himself. And this is the destiny of every person who relies on power, not from God. This is the truth. This is what it looks like. When we grasp for power because we think that if we possess enough of it, we can ease our anxieties, provide our security, give us what we want, what we think we need, and protect us from what we fear. Judges tells us exactly what that leads to. It exposes just how absurd this is, because every ounce of true power is borrowed from God. It's given to us over by God. It is His strength. And Eglon is what happens when we forget that everything we have comes from God. We look at what we possess and we can think it belongs to us. So we grasp for more, but we must stop reaching. Like Adam, stop grasping for more things that aren't ours to control. And allow God to show us how powerful He truly is. We must become strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might, because the picture of power apart from its source is still sat there in Judges. It's lying there dead on the floor. One day, as Judges 3:25 says, every lord will fall, every earthly throne will collapse, every power we trust apart from God will fail us. No amount of money, security, no amount of planning or anxiety will stop the result that death comes. No amount of power will stop that end for us. And every false power we make lord of our lives will lie dead on the floor. But Christ is different. As Hebrews 2:14-15 says, Christ is different. He is the king who laid down his life, who entered death itself and rose victorious. Every false king we make lord of our lives ends up like Eglon, but the one true king who died now lives forever. And that's the crux of Judges 3, of Adam's story, of our lives. It's not whether or not God's power is enough for you. It's whether or not you believe it is. Do you trust in the Lord and His strength and the strength of His might? And so the only question we have left tonight is simply, where does your power lie? Let's go to God in prayer.